Today's episode of The Grave Talks is brought to you by Best Fiends. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. It's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Today on The Grave Talks, how to communicate with spirits. A conversation with Andy Guy. After hearing countless ghost stories about the pub that Andy Guy's brother-in-law ran, he knew he wanted to experience something for himself. Even though he would spend countless hours sitting in the most haunted areas of the pub, Andy would walk away empty-handed. However, that didn't discourage his drive to find answers. Years later, Andy would go on to find answers and create a whole new list of questions and custom equipment to try to answer them on. This is his story on The Grave Talks.
So for me, it was. A lot of people have stories where they've seen something or witnessed something. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was always kind of, it started off academic. So this, literally when I was in secondary school, so from the age of 9 onwards, That's literally all I would take from the school library is ghost books and paranormal books. And got to the stage where I was doing that so often. I had an English teacher who was making me take out these romance novels just to try and change what I was listening and watching and reading to. But so after reading a lot of this, there's one of the books called the Osborne Book of Ghosts. Absolutely fascinated me because it was so much in there. There's so many stories and pictures and ways of ghost hunting. Mm-hmm. But the real kind of the spark and the interest to actually kind of focus into it is actually when my sister used to be married to the landlord of a pub called the Red Lion in Southampton, Which is a really old building. It's literally 15th century, and historically it was meant to be the court for Henry V, and he tried this plot there, and these people were marched from the pub and then executed. So it was a very kind of historic building in Southampton.
Yeah.
And when I'd visit her at this pub and say that they kind of kept it as much as possible, kind of medieval. So they had suits of armor on the wall. They had flintlock muskets on the wall and daggers. And I got told the story that when they were renovating the restaurant part, they'd taken down parts of the chimney and found a skeleton in there.
Oh, my God.
So it really captured my imagination, yeah. And I started hearing stories from, there was a lady called April who worked in the kitchen, and she said that every time she went into the pantry, she felt like something was touching her. And there's a lodger who was on the first floor, had a room, who wouldn't leave the room at night because there was footsteps on the staircase in front of him. And most interestingly as well is the landlord, a guy called Ian, who's my brother-in-law, said that when people were having meals in the restaurant bit, which they'd kind of renovated, some of the things would be taken off the walls. So like this flintlock musket and a little dagger, which they'd screwed to the wall, would come off the wall and land in people's ploughmen and sludges. So with me and my ghost book, there was a section in there which told you like what to write on a pad and to ask people, like, where were you when you saw this, and what time was it, and what happened. And I was taking notes of all these people's stories.
Yeah.
And eventually I decided to do that as a show and tell in my junior school.
Okay.
And my my brother-in-law lent me one of these flintlock muskets and a dagger to take into school and then show everyone to tell them about this story about this ghost that was investigating in this pub.
So did you ever get a chance to go in? Did you go into the pub ever yourself? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I used to stay there with my sister on quite a few nights and Fortunately never witnessed anything myself, even though I sat on that staircase waiting for the footsteps outside the guy's room.
Yeah.
Never saw a thing there.
Nothing. All the stories, but it's almost like when you're looking too hard, you don't end up seeing it.
Mm.
Wow.
Isn't that often the truth?
It is. Yeah. Well, that's so interesting. So is there more to the story, or does that kind of sum it up what we just talked about?
That is it. So beyond that, I kept on reading more and more about the paranormal up until the age of about, I don't know, 22 or so, when my girlfriend found a ghost hunt to go to, which is Woodchester Mansion in Gloucestershire,
okay.
Which is a Victorian mansion which was kind of like a country home type situation where they sort of used it as a holiday home, but it never got finished. So the entire building is a kind of a shell. And we went there, and my goal was really just to see, was there really anything to it? Was there something in the paranormal at all? And I actually had an interesting experience on that night, which was as we were walking around, because I'd kind of done a lot of work in sort of understanding the situation and watching a lot of ghost shows, I turned up my first investigation with a Mel meter and a night vision camcorder and a K2 meter.
Okay.
Just decked out. I'd spent a lot of money for my first event. I wasn't even sure I wanted to keep doing it or not, but I'd spent a lot of money on it. And as we were leaving the building, I was walking with my camcorder. I walked past this section of the wall with a room which was sort of blocked off. And I thought I saw someone in there. And I thought, oh, we didn't go in that room. I think I might pop into that room. But as I turned my camcorder towards it, it was completely barred off, and there was just kind of piles of rubbish in there, and there was no one there. So I said, is anyone there? Is anyone watching me? Then I heard in my ears, because I was having my earphones attached to the camera, and I heard, Arthur. And I was like, okay, you just told me your name? Is your name Arthur? And nothing at all after that. But luckily, got home, checked the camera. It's clearly on there. And from that point, I thought, yeah, I think I want to go do this again. Plus, I've just spent all this money on the equipment, so I probably should.
So obviously you had the interest and the passion, and just, you know, digging into the topic and hearing other stories was very satisfying to you for a long period of time. Was that was that your first, like, encounter or experience with the paranormal when you heard Arthur?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd been interested in it, but I never actually experienced anything until that point.
Wow. Well, that's exciting. I mean, when you had that experience and you got that on tape, what's running through your mind at that moment? Are you thinking, this is truly a ghost? Are you trying to debunk it? What are you thinking?
So it was a busy night. The group I went with was a little out of control, and there was a lot of running around and screaming and shouting. So I've got a very kind of skeptical head. So I'm thinking, I heard it. I'm not sure the location, could have been someone else. So I literally kind of just left myself trying to be open about it and decided that I want to try and look into this more, see if I can witness anything in a more controlled environment to really understand if there is something, because I was still in that, is there something to it phase.
Sure.
And then later on, I changed into looking for something else.
Yeah. So you have this experience, you get this piece of evidence. Where does that, where does things continue from there for you?
So I decided to look around for a different group that's going to be a little more controlled. So I know if something happens, you know, we know it's not someone else's voice and someone else running around, and start going to lots of other different venues. And still, I'm still very open to it, like 20 or 30 investigations into different locations. And until I hit a bit of a tipping point, I think, with the amount of different individual pieces, and then decided instead to focus on what is it. I hit a point, I think, probably about 2 or 3 years into it, where I thought, right, I've witnessed enough little things. I'm fairly sure there's something to this. I just don't know what it is. And we were in a place called Margam Castle, which is in the south of Wales. Beautiful building, a couple hundred years old. But the interesting thing is that they were using it as the set for the Da Vinci series. So they set dressed it to look like Renaissance Italy, even though it's a Welsh castle.
Okay.
So it was a little bit disconcerting when we're sitting in these rooms, which you're like, okay, this was the prisoner's room, and it was lush and plush, and it had a nice four poster bed and stuff.
Yeah.
But I was sitting there, and I was talking to a couple of people in the group, and it was middle of summer, so it was like August, and nothing really much was happening. We were trying lots of things, and it was just kind of dead. And someone said, "Isn't it funny how it's always really quiet in the summer?" And I thought, you know what? That is interesting. Why is it sometimes you go to a location and it's really, there's lots of things happening, and then you go another night, nothing at all. So I started thinking, okay, let's try and pick this apart. So what I wanted to do was to look if there was any environmental conditions. So anything kind of that you could record, like, you know, temperature and humidity and stuff. But also the time of day, moon cycles, times, people in the location. If there's any sort of combination of conditions, which meant that something was more likely to happen or not, if that would enable it or make it easier for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I changed from thinking, is there something to this, to more, how does this happen? And then focused everything I did on that. Which led to a bunch of new skills. So I learned how to build Arduinos and data loggers and codes and websites.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things to support that drive. I'm still doing that now,
years
later, just focusing on gathering as much information, trying to spot patterns.
So you were spotting patterns. So you were getting very much into the kind of the technical side of how can we understand this better? And is that accurate? Mm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And my real goal was kind of more like how to predict.
Yeah.
How to say that when these conditions are present,
mm-hmm.
you're more likely to get something or not.
Back to the conversation in just a moment. First, I want to thank our supporter today, Best Fiends. When I get a little bit of downtime, which is rare, but every once in a while, I get a little bit of downtime. Like, okay, I'm just going to go over here for a few minutes. And then, yeah, I love to take this out and play it. It's a Best Fiends. It's my mental palate cleanser. It really is. It's like, okay, take a little pause from life. Come back. You got to check this out. It never gets boring, okay? This thing, it is always updated. New levels, new challenges all the time. Right now, I'm on level 622. You got to check this out for yourself. Best Fiends is a mobile puzzle game that anyone can download and play. Whether you have a few minutes or a few hours, Best Fiends is the perfect puzzle game to lose yourself in because you're having so much fun. The game features tons of cute characters, helps you solve thousands of puzzles. The more you play, the more characters you collect, and so on. And the more you win, the more challenges you face. Like I said, it's updated all the time, new stuff. Please check it out. You're going to love it. Thousands of levels. You can literally play as long as you want and never get bored. Trust me on that. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. And tell me about that, because I've wondered about that many times. And, you know, you try and find those sort of patterns and go, well, these conditions were ripe for this. But at the same point, you know, as with all of this, well, the same thing happened over here and it was not at all those same conditions. So what have you learned over the years? What are some of the interesting things that you've come across that you maybe were surprised by?
Okay, biggest surprise.
Yeah.
Moon phases. So traditionally you think full moon, lots of energy, you know, in sort of spiritualist traditions, which are kind of, I kind of dabbled on when I was younger, but full moons is a lot of energy, or kind of the waxing phases, lots of energy building up.
Mm-hmm.
But when every event that occurs, we log it on a database. Mm-hmm. We also log what the moon phase was. So I can say that full moon, and there's 8 moon phases, only just under 5%, so 4.995% of events occur during a full moon. Whereas in the first quarter, 20.79.
The first quarter being one night?
So the quarters are a few days. There's okay. a few days for each section.
Okay. So,
yeah, so the 5 months split into 8, basically.
Okay. So the full moon has a couple days as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Because I was going to say, well, if you're counting one day versus, you know, but I'm sure you've already figured that part out. So the, so how interesting, and this is based on data that, I mean, what sort of data sets do you have? Like how in depth does it go? How deep does it go?
So, quite deep. In fact, so we categorize events that occur, into A, B's and C's. And it's quite a simple thing. So A is we've tried everything to debunk this.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got no other ideas now how to debunk this. I've got evidence I can show people to prove it. If anyone's got ideas, then we'll try them. But they're kind of that's how we go with Class A. B is it's really good. We don't know what it is, but we've got some ideas about what we want to try next time we go. and C is everything else. So these things we've captured, we've recorded. I can show you the footage, all the audio, whatever.
Yeah.
But it isn't conclusively paranormal. If you said, is this the proof of life after death? And I heard three knocks, I couldn't say, yes, those prove life after death. So for that, say, first quarter one, I've got 63 recorded events, which are class A's or B's. Mm-hmm. And then down to that full moon one, where it's only 15.
Why do you think that is? I mean, based, you know, that being a surprise, what sort of, you know, reasoning have you run through your mind to try and explain that?
There's another one which might tie into it. I don't know, because we need to make some equipment which we can deal with it.
Sure.
But, and I'll skip a bit and I'll come back to it if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, sure.
So the other one which has come up again and again is a variation in air pressure, in actual air density. Mm-hmm. So what we've seen is we basically measure once a second on the air pressure in both the location we're standing, outside the building, and other areas around the building. So when we see any fluctuations, we can then, after the event, go back and look at the exact same point in time around the building. And if it's natural, if there's suddenly a storm coming in or a big truck's got buzz, maybe, but we just go, that's just natural. So we've seen this fluctuation up to 7 millibars and above in a kind of a very sharp increase that occurs at the same time or just before other things happening, K2s or footsteps or... a lot of creaking and knocking, etc.
Yeah.
So, but then when you get into a kind of a period where it's higher or it's a longer period, you're kind of seeing other things like people getting prodded or lots of devices all going off at the same time. And the interesting thing there is one of the things going to impact air pressure is gravity. Mm-hmm. So however much gravity there is, that's how hard the air is getting pulled down towards the planet or away from it. And one thing the moon does is slightly changes the gravity as it's going round. I'm not sure about the phase, because that's actually just light. But I don't know. I'm sort of kind of feeling that there's some sort of correlation between the two.
Yeah.
Need to figure out. I want to basically make something that I can use to measure gravity, but from what I've seen, that's a tough call.
So there's a lot of things here, and some of these things, a lot of these things actually cannot necessarily be, replicated, because it's a place the world is in at certain times of day and years and months. So it's not like, oh, let's add this to the equation. It's, kind of there, or it's not. But take those things, take the moon phases out of the equation, take other things out of the equation. What have you found to be, I guess, a good recipe with things that are influenceable by this, or atmospheres that can be created by us, for a haunting or for activity to be more active, if you will?
Okay, it's controversial, but I do have some techniques which are quite reliable, and reliable as they can be.
Okay.
And that's kind of getting to know the location as much as possible. So learning the history of it, learning who's there now, understanding the context that building exists in, work out who are the characters of this place, what were their stories. And when I go to a location, I mean, and a lot of people don't like to learn all about the place because they like to pick up information and go, yep, that actually relates to something. But in reality, I'd rather use the information and see what we can do with it. Mm-hmm. So whenever I go to, not whenever, but quite often, and focus on things like that. So like talking about, just with other people around, just talking about the story, empathizing about what was going on, not being in a condescending way, just trying to be in a sort of a kind of same headspace as that person, mm-hmm. and trying to see their situation from maybe their side as well.
Yeah.
Or try things like figure out what era music they're interested in. So take that along, especially when we do a lot of thoughts. I've got an MP3 player full of different marches from different centuries, mm-hmm. which has been quite useful sometimes. playing and get to the point where we can work out the what regiment is actually having more responses than other regiments.
Wow.
So that's quite interesting as well. If I go to a place called Fort Purbrook, which is just above Portsmouth on this ring of forts, which never saw any battle because it was built just in case Napoleon's son came across. Mm-hmm. And we play any Royal Artillery music, it's about three out of four times you'd get other piece of equipment start going off, and sometimes in time to the music.
That's interesting.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what would be controversial about what you just described?
I think the history part of it. I think there's a lot of people, when they investigate, they'd like to go in not knowing the location and having being a clean slate.
Okay.
And anything that happens, then they can say, I spoke to Edward, and then try and investigate and research it. And they find an Edward, sure. And they go, yep, that proves that what I picked up was correct. Whereas I think kind of the opposite. If you go and then you talk about Edward Smith and what happened to him, and he had a brother and they fell out, and then you get a response, I think that's probably better at identifying a potential person who might be still there rather than linking two bits of information that are outside the event, basically. So you're doing that away from the person, so you can't really correlate it with them until you go back.
I agree with you on that. I think quite often it gets overlooked that the entities, if we are talking to them or communicating with them, they were once people too. And they probably get sick of being asked the same five questions over and over by every investigator that goes in there. If you can, just as if you were talking to a human being or you're planning on interviewing somebody or meeting somebody, maybe look a little bit up about them and have something to kind of go with that shows you're interested, that shows that, you know, there's some relatability there versus just tell me whatever you want to tell me. You know, it's more of a human connection that you're making, I think, with what you're doing versus just what's your name? Why are you here? You know, that sort of stuff.
I usually use the analogy of walking into a pub.
Yeah.
So if you walked into a pub and said, right, who wants to talk to me? Mm-hmm. Everyone would just look at their drinks and completely ignore you.
Exactly.
But if you walked in and said, hello there, I heard there's a guy here called John who won the darts tournament 2 weeks ago. Any chance I can, you know, buy him a pint and we could have a chat or a game of darts?
Yeah.
You'd find John's mate, and then you'd be having some buddies to drink with the rest of the night.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's taking more of a humanistic approach to this than just the very raw approach that so many have. So I think it makes sense. I understand what, you know, some of the controversy would be and some of the drawback, but if you're still getting activity that you can't explain how it's happening, what does it matter how you got it going, as long as it's respectful?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are some approaches which just kind of grate when I'm hearing them. So mm-hmm. when someone says, spirit, talk to me, spirit, do this. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, I don't like the sound of you saying that. So who would want to interact with you when you're
exactly.
being commanded to do something?
Yeah. Yeah. What are your thoughts? I mean, obviously, I'm going to assume it's not good because most of us feel this way. But, you know, where people get really, you know, interrogative with the spirits, you know, condescending, almost yelling, provoking, really, when it's not just a conversation, when people really get in there and provoke. I know some will swear that that's how they get a lot of activity and such. But is that really a great way of approaching something?
You know what? When I first started myself, and we watched a lot of ghost shows, and you know, there's a couple where they did a lot more of that than other ones.
Yeah,
and I think I tried it maybe once or twice, and it's just firstly, it's not in my character, mm-hmm. and secondly, it felt like I wouldn't talk to a person like this. So
yeah.
So why am I trying to? I'm trying to link and communicate with someone. Then why would I push them away in this way? I can understand maybe the concept of you're trying to almost make them angry and upset enough with you to then do something, but I don't know. I do think it's very disrespectful when people are trying to make whatever's there perform, in effect.
Yeah.
And for them. And that doesn't feel like that's something that would really want to engage with you.
Well, and I don't think you really get much meaningful communication. Like, maybe you'll trigger something. No. But that person that, now that you angered them, you think they're going to, if you were doing this with a human, are they going to want to sit down and talk with you or do anything else you ask? I mean, no, they're going to want to throw some shit. No. And then, you know, maybe you'll see the results of something, you know, basically on that side that they were angry. Interesting. So tell me more about, you know, as you investigate, I know one of the things, you know, that you're big on is creating your own types of devices and things of that nature. I know you touched on that a little bit here when we were talking, but tell me more about that world of things that you use to go out there and study this and try and get interesting results and evidence and such.
So, The first thing I focused on was trying to get some sort of data logger together. So I built a very rudimentary data logger using an Arduino, which is a small kind of consumer-grade microprocessor. You can plug lots of different sensors in and then put that in an SD card. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that that's kind of a little bit limiting. I'll carry it around on a tripod, and at that time I was carrying about 5 or 6 tripods around locations with cameras, mm-hmm. and parabolic dishes and this data logger. So then I built another device, I call it a spider, because it's based on a concept I saw in one of my books from school in the 70s, where there's some guys at university created this trolley, which had an old computer on it and a lot of sensors that came off with wires all over the room. And they called it a spider because it looked like a spider sitting amongst a web, but mine has no web yet.
Okay.
But I built one of those that actually was in a backpack. So its sensor array was kind of at the back behind me. And then I got a nice audio recorder, a Roland, and 2 dynamic microphones. So left channel 1, right channel 1, and then put those in vibration mounts on the back side of me, so they're pointing in totally opposite directions. So whenever we record any audio, we know exactly where it is in the room, pretty much, by both myself and my girlfriend wearing these packs, which have got a night vision camera, the sensor array, and these directional microphones. Mm-hmm. You could then, with a pair of earphones, work out where sounds, etc., are coming from. But beyond that, I then tried to build some smaller ones you could drop around the place that recorded them out of EMF and sort of REM pod approach, etc. Mm-hmm. And lots of things for specific locations. So, like, there's a pub in Wales called the Skirrid Inn, and once we slept there, and during the night I left a camera running while we were in bed. And that sounds bad, but
really, so honey, it's for ghosts. It's for catching ghosts. Why is it aimed directly at? Yeah. They might be around us. It's okay. I will. Running. If there's nothing there, I will erase the footage. I promise. Yeah.
Lucky I didn't erase the footage. Is there? Hang on, this time that's made worse. Right. Yeah. Okay. Next.
Yeah.
So on the footage after we watched it back, we heard this rustling noise by the camera, and then the bathroom door open and close, which was right next to the bed. Mm-hmm. And then there's a very famous spirit that's meant to be in the location called Fanny Price, who was a barmaid. In fact, she was the landlady of the place, and people hear her skirts rustling. I thought, this is amazing. So next time, and the camera wasn't pointing the door, unfortunately, it was pointing exactly the wrong direction. So next time, I built an ultrasonic rangefinder and had it record the distance to that door for the entire night and before we went home. So I don't know how many hours, 16 hours, something. Nothing happened whatsoever, of course. But during the last 2 years, when not doing much investigating, I'd had a number of people approach me for bits of the equipment I was making. And I thought, I'd like to do this, because I'm a big believer in the scientific method. And part of that is, if you've found some results, if part of your experiment has generated some results, you need to share that. You need to let other people do the same experiment and see if they get the same results. Mm-hmm. So I started designing bits of kit which I would use on investigation, but also then supported some of the things we found. One of those being a device I call the Aeroflux, because it's a air fluctuation meter that's got built into it that pattern that I was seeing when we were witnessing events. And then all they have to do is switch it on, and it looks for that pattern, and then flashes when it sees the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And then see it, basically, if other people who are using these, then we're also seeing things happen. And the nice thing is I've been working with a lot of groups now for the last year, and they're seeing these things going off pretty consistently with other bits of equipment as they're investigating. So it's nice to see things that we've seen, really we've witnessed out there, other groups independently doing it.
No, that's got to be very interesting and rewarding as well. Well, there's obviously a lot of equipment that's out there, that you don't have to make yourself. But you know, there's various opinions on things that you know, what's reliable, what's not. What are your thoughts, you know, on the things that are out there that are, you know, readily available? I mean, obviously, you know, recorders, EVPs, we understand how that works. But things like the Ovilises and other devices that ghost boxes and things of that nature. What are your feelings on some of those things?
So there are definitely some that I've seen which are built for almost, let's say, like TV shows for entertainment purposes. And I had an Ovilus for a while, and I like the concept of it. So I tried to find out more about how it worked. And there's not a lot of information out there, but I found out that it uses temperature and EMF. Mm-hmm. And from those two readings, when it sees changes, takes those numbers from those changes, goes to a database and says that word. And as soon as I found that out, I thought, right, how would I know how much to change that temperature and EMF by to make that word? Mm-hmm. So if I don't know how to do that, how would a spirit know how to do that? So I sold it. soon as I kind of figured that out, I sold mm-hmm. that and got a trigger object bear, which then went off if it detected temperature or EMF. Because mm-hmm. I thought, if I'm investigating, I want to know what's setting this off. And I want to be able to interact with whatever setting off to say how they can do it again. So interestingly, and it's a little bit exclusive because I've not really kind of put this out much anywhere, my next bit of kit is, I don't want to say like an Ovilus, it's more like that bear, because I built a device which does temperature and EMF and air fluctuations and magnetism, which is another one which is a kind of interesting,
mm-hmm.
and has words which are in a scale and sort of related. So the words for some emotions, so happy, excited, angry, or sad, low, depressed, all on the temperature axis.
Okay.
So if you get one of those words, you could say, okay, you're feeling happy. Are you sure you're feeling happy? If you want to see if you can increase the temperature, then you can tell us if you're angry. If that's not right, you can decrease the temperature. You just tell us how you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And all the different axes for those different things create a type of word which is consistent, well, not necessarily consistent, but at least predictable, and you can use it when you're calling out, because you can actually, you know what's going off and why,
mm-hmm.
and I can explain that. So then you can get a bit of a two-way approach. Yeah, which I think is a bit of a step. I don't like things which interpret the data, but you don't see that interpretation.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Andy Guy. In part two, what are some of the ghost hunting tools that Andy believes could be improved upon? And what sort of improvements has he made? What does the future hold for sensing the supernatural in an investigative setting? Those questions and more in part two of our interview. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. Sign up at patreon.com/thegravetalks or go to thegravetalks.com and click become a Gravekeeper. You'll get access to part two of all of our episodes, all of them commercial free, and you can binge away on them for weeks or longer. Trust me, there are hundreds of episodes just waiting for you. Patreon.com/thegravetalks. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.